Do you need a kiss goodnight?
Yeah, it's a hug and a kiss.
A hug and a kiss. Okay, here's a big hug. And here's the kiss. I love you.
That's my turn.
That's your turn. Okay. Welcome to a double episode of TV's Flashcast for Sons of Anarchy. Philip Moslak and I went rogue last week. This is Lisa Schmeiser coming back to you with our breakdown of episode 3 and episode 4 on Sons of Anarchy.
We went full on nomad.
Yeah, off the grid, man, brother.
So now we're back.
That's the charitable explanation. I think the less charitable explanation is episode 3 was so boring it put us to sleep and it took this week to wake us up.
Oh, but, okay, right.
But first, let's recap episode 3 super quick.
Do it.
All right, let me bring up the handy Sons of Anarchy timer. All right, SOA explainer timer, I have it. So, for episode 3, here's what you need to know. First thing, lots of people get dead. Yes. Although I don't know why I mentioned that. That happens every week. We start off the episode with your standard cleave shot. It's Red Woody Productions is up and running. It looks like Lila is in line to become the next Luann. Oh, nice assonance there. Other things that are noteworthy developments. Borofsky's been dragged back into things. And he's not too happy with the direction Jax is taking. August Marks is turning into the voice of truth on this show because he lays it down straight for Jax. Tells him this doesn't work if we can't trust each other. Trust can't live in the same space as secrets and lies, which is basically the theme for the entire series when you think about it. Jax absorbs this warning and then promptly dumps it out his other ear. His revenge play is a sign that his grief is making him dumb. So what he does is he sets up the Niners and the Mayans and the Chinese to all shoot each other. It doesn't work. All right. That was a minute.
Well, it's,
and you know what? That was piss poor because, pardon my language, I left out one of the creepiest and most unsettling things in the episode, which is the B plot where some poor hooker, Diosa, is being slapped around by her abusive dad. Gemma, of course, steps into the middle of this for reasons that pass beyond understanding. After dad hits her, by the end of the episode, Gemma comes by with a cake and then six Jacks on him. And that mother-son team-up is like the most disturbing thing I've seen so far.
And you know, the interesting thing is, for the previews of the whole season, I've been waiting for that scene where Jax comes in and throws down the five-sided fistagon.
Yeah.
And the rest of the episode was just more moving of furniture with some stuff going in motion.
Yeah, even the humor fell flat because the funniest moment came at the 2-minute mark where they had the organ music playing in the background while Skankenstein's monster was being zapped to life. And the fact that this porn production goes to all of the trouble to get like legitimate Bela Lugosi style organ music, for some reason that struck me as the most hilarious thing in the hour. And indeed it was.
The light up nipples were interesting.
I remember they had an interview with Kelly Jones, who does the costuming for the show, and she was talking about how a lot of the extras and background people on Sons of Anarchy actually do work in the adult industry. And one of the biggest challenges they actually tend to have are costuming these people and keeping them from behaving as though they're on an adult set. And so I do wonder if that's where they went. Because I can't imagine some poor woman straight out of Juilliard going, "Oh, you mean my first part on television is going to be me with this crazy crazy bra contraption and some of the worst, quote-unquote, acting ever?" Because it was super funny. You had Dr. Skankenstein, and she's like, "Charge it again." It was just...
Yeah. Well, and they seem to be so, like, in that particular opening scene, it seems to be so... Or we're at least led to believe this is such a triumphant time because they've just shot a scene. And the craziest thing about the scene is the eye like candy between Jax and what's her smell?
Lila?
Yeah.
So what I wanted to point out is if you remember the Kara Kara plot line showed up in season 2.
Uh-oh.
Where... And again, I'm working off of the theory that just like season 1 and season 6 were funhouse mirror images of each other, my crackpot theory that season 7 is a funhouse mirror image of season 2 is beginning to get a little bit more a little bit more anecdotal evidence to support it. Because what I noticed about this is you watch Lila's posture in the chair and the professional, cool, appraising eye that she has, and then the reference that she makes later in the episode about how she's going to be in post-production all day. And I thought, she's the new Luann.
Yep.
This series is going to end with Lila as the new Luann, who is somebody who is simultaneously empowered for a given definition of empowered. Empowered as a businesswoman and somebody who's managed to ascend a career path and yet utterly indebted to a club that could destroy her at any time.
It just seems like the slow boat to death.
Mm-hmm.
But if
we've learned anything in 6.25 seasons of Sons of Anarchy, if you're a sex worker and you know a member of Sam Crow, your life expectancy has just been shortened dramatically.
Especially if you get to episode 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Right, that's right. That's right.
To keep talking about episode 3, I got to be honest with you, with all of the zipping around that Jax is doing and lying through his teeth to everyone he encounters and going behind August Mark's back, which I think is actually going to be the biggest mistake he makes this season. I was kind of bored by that. What I thought was interesting, though, was Gemma continues to fall apart. And at the 56-minute mark, she's talking to the Crows.
Again.
And she's saying to them, well, you know, I look at these boys and I just see everything happened as it's meant to be. And I thought, oh my God, we're back to season 2 again. Because remember, Gemma kind of goes off the deep end after her gang rape. And when she, quote unquote, finds God, she tells Tara, God has a purpose for me. I'm meant to be God's tough mother. And, you know, that was when she had a big dramatic break emotionally and was trying to rebuild herself. And it's happening again where she's trying to console herself. Because she's a preacher's kid. She's trying to console herself with, it's all meant to be. I just have to accept it and live with the consequences and bear this burden because I'm a sinner. And I thought, wow, it's the huge parallel between season 2 and season 7. And I don't see this ending well.
Well, you know, it's just bizarre because, you know, she's just constantly, you know, talking to Tara.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard her talk that nice to anybody.
Well, now she's got the relationship she's always wanted with her daughter-in-law. Tara can't talk back.
I think that must be the case. But
I think we've talked about this, where I've always seen the Gemma-Tara relationship as one of the most heartbreaking on the show, because Tara was a motherless daughter, and Gemma is a childless mother in some ways. Like, she lost Thomas, and she never had a daughter, and she herself was pretty poorly mothered. And so I think those two characters had always recognized the loss in each other and responded to it. And for me, one of the biggest heartbreaks of the series was that instead of becoming this strong family is what you make it through love and affection and action type of family they were, they end up on opposite sides with their own definitions of family, and one kills the other. I mean, to me, that's the biggest heartbreak of the series, is not Jax's slide into evil or whatever. To me, the biggest heartbreak of the series is that over and over again, Gemma had this opportunity to create an actual whole family with a woman who needed one, and she kept sabotaging it over and over again.
And the crazy thing is, I mean, and maybe I'm not seeing it for what it is. Has the entire storyline thus far, like going back to episode 1, season mm-hmm. 1, mm-hmm. is it always been kind of Jax and Gemma? Because it just seems like it's full Gemma right now, at least.
Now I've done a season rewatch of season 1 much more recently than season 2. And then I did 3. But yeah, the Jax Gemma relationship has always been central to the show. Always. And that was actually, it was pretty heavily implied, I thought, that one of Jax's biggest issues with Clay was that Clay took Gemma's loyalty away from Jax in a way.
Okay.
And what I find, again, kind of tragic about this season is that, you know, Gemma killed Tara because she thought Tara was coming between her and Jax and the life that she wants for Jax. But now that she has to keep the secret, she and Jax are going to put, are ping-ponging further apart, and it's her own doing.
Yeah, and but he's being used. Oh, I guess what's really kind of twisting me as a fan is the way in which she's using Jax as a weapon. You know, she set him in directions that aren't even, you know, we know that are out and out lies, but he is a bullet. And have you noticed also Jax?
And she aimed him right at that father. And then in episode four, which we may as well skip ahead to, because these two are kind of bookends. In episode four, Nero tells her, you have to stop helping Jax do stuff like this. It gets to the point where it's not about revenge anymore. You're doing it just because it feels good. And, you know, he speaks this truth to Gemma, and she immediately rejects it because she doesn't want to be told how she's hurting Jax. Like, she literally cannot face the enormity of what she's done to Jax, and so she's just going to keep deflecting and avoiding and denying it.
Have you noticed that he's smoking way more?
A lot, yeah.
Like, every scene, he is lighting up.
Yeah, no, it's a lot. I am trying to get a beat on how Hunnam is playing him right now, because I have to admit that is one of the things that I'm having a hard time with. Like when Tig watched his daughter go up in flames, as it were, Kim Coates has been playing him since then as somebody who's tremendously sad and subdued on some level.
I agree completely.
And haunted.
Oh, you know, yeah.
And you watch his reactions in different episodes, and this is a guy who never has a moment's rest from his grief. And that's how he plays it. I just think Kim Coates is great on the show, period. He may be one of the more underrated, like, people tend to talk about how great some of the other performances are, but I think honestly that Kim Coates has done some fantastic work, and in many ways he's the heart of the show. Like, he's just such a thoughtful, he just has such a thoughtful depiction of Tig. So Kim Coates, like, or I should say Tig, I buy as somebody who is never going to get over what he saw, and he carries it with him. And Opie, like, Ryan Hurst played Opie the same way through seasons two through seasons two, what, six was it that he died?
Or five? Five.
Yeah, seasons two through five, like, there was just this huge heaviness to everything. Like, in season one, he's kind of a mote because he's all conflicted. And then the poor guy gets, like, literally half an episode where, like, his whole life is finally in order and he's made his decision and he's at peace with it. And then Donna gets killed. And in seasons two, three, four, and part of five, like, you see him getting progressively more knotted up inside. And every choice he makes is wrong. And he knows it. And he's literally trapped. He can't see any way out of it. He's got no support. And he's not a thinker like Jack, so he can't think his way clear. You know, so we have a great example of Opie grieving. We have a great example of Tig grieving. I would argue that Ron Perlman's performance through all of season six was a man who was grieving the loss of the love of his life. Like, I don't think the losing the club mattered to him half so much as losing Gemma did. And like, that's how he plays it the whole time. It's beautiful. Jax finds his murdered wife on the floor, like a fork sticking out of her head or whatever.
Right.
Finds his murdered wife, and you know, I get that they're supposed to be, oh, he's a remorseless killing machine right now because he's numb or whatever. But, like, there's just, I can't figure out if he's just not inhabiting the scenes because the idea is that, oh, Jax is checked out. And so now he's just going by rote, or if it's supposed to be, well, Jax is gone and the grief and the anger have eaten him up to the point where we don't know this guy anymore or what. But I just feel like Charlie Hunnam's performance is really opaque right now, and I can't get a handle on it.
Yeah. It's almost like, okay, so, yeah, all these bad things have happened, but I'm going to be Machiavellian in my route to have everybody shoot each other and be this ultimate strategist.
That's like a comic book villain.
And it really is. And he's really not giving much emotion to either. I mean, some of the times it's smug. It's smug with Marx.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing that drives me nuts is I'm like, from a getting invested in the character point of view, I'm like, dude, Marx is worse than Pope ever was.
And he clearly defines it.
Because here's the thing is, like, you know, they make the point, Damon Pope, when we met him, he was clearly driven by emotion. He had aspirations and he had goals and he genuinely wanted to go legit. He was kind of the Michael Corleone of, you know, of the black gangster scene. When you think about it, August Marx is a whole different animal. He's somebody who is like, I will accept this lie because it's expedient. I now have collateral though, and I'm going to use it. Like, he's a thinking animal, as it were, you know, as opposed to just a reflexive killing machine. And he's given Jax a billion warnings as to how things are going to have to run if Jax wants to keep his life. And every time he said something to Jax, Jax is like, yeah, yeah, whatever. And this is not going to end well for you, my friend.
Yeah. And the only thing that I can think of is, mm-hmm. again, there is a lot of shorthand going on. And yeah. I have to say, this agreement with Tully and the white supremacists, there mm-hmm. is a ton of this storyline that we have not seen.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, you know what? Let's do the quickie recap for episode 4, and then we can segue into the white supremacists. All right. Bringing the timer back up again. New timer. So SOA explainer starting now. All right. The most noteworthy thing that happens in this episode is that the Lin Triad finally realizes how Jax Teller's gang has been playing it. They wreak an incredibly bloody and awful revenge. And the reason it's bloody and awful is it all takes place off screen and the boys are just left to take a look at the results. I hope you weren't too attached to the ice cream shop. It's gone now. Other notable developments, Juice continues to spiral into self-destructiveness. Both he and Gemma end up with guns in their bags, so somebody's getting shot on the road to Oregon, which, by the way, is where they're headed. And we meet Courtney Love as Abel's preschool teacher, which is a stunt casting move that I'm curious to see how that works. I loved her in The People versus Larry Flint. I can't help feel now that Kurt Sutter is basically trying to recreate Lollapalooza in the last season of Sons of Anarchy with his casting choices. Also, the police and the Sons of Anarchy establish a working relationship that's productive for approximately 20 minutes until the white supremacists show up and ruin everything by shooting a couple deputies, one in the head, another one 4 times in the back. This alerts Annabeth. Oh, I missed it. This alerts Annabeth Gish to the fact that she's dealing with a corrupt town and mass murderers. And it pretty much alerts Unser to the fact that he keeps putting his neck out for again, psychos and killers.
Okay. Two big things you've missed.
Okay.
There's a lot of love in episode 4. A whole lot of love. You have mm-hmm. Chibs. Is mm-hmm. And again, this is where I go with the shorthand. Mm-hmm. There is a lot with Chibs and the sheriff. And it's completely been unspoken. She calls him Scotty or the Scotty. And then at the end of the episode, when, you know, everything's blown up, we have mm-hmm. a lot of hand holding. And then we have the kiss of kisses. Tiggs and Venus.
You're right. I completely missed the Tig and Venus thing. How could I forget after ranting about Kim Combs?
I know. That's why I'm here.
I love your theme about love, because here is another example. It's the son and the mother. Because he does his best to shoot the sons before managing to drive himself and his mom into a lake. But he defends his mother to the end. He tries to save her. And while the Sons of Anarchy totally screw over this very nice preacher's wife and her son, the filial bond that's between the two of them, it's kind of like, again, the Funhouse Mirror version of Jax and Gemma, where he hated his stepfather. He watched his stepfather corrupt his stepmother and his mother, and now there's an opportunity for him to be free of this if they just pay off one last big payoff thing. And in a way, that's kind of the Teller Morrow story in reverse. But yeah, let's talk Tig and Venus.
Well, I mean, look, we now know that Tig's real name is Alexander.
We've known that for a while.
Well, maybe you did.
What I like is that Venus talk tells him that.
Exactly. And and then we have this whole, should I be worried? Should I be worried? We've been keeping in touch. Again.
And it's funny because it's played for comedy where Jax is kind of grinning, should I be worried?
Right.
And everyone's like, oh, ha, ha, ha. And then it turns out that, you know, I'm not sure if worry is the word that you need to use, man. Just.
But, you know, to be honest, you know, for as crazy as it sounds, mm-hmm. that was a really endearing scene. Like, even I think it was the last time we saw Venus.
Mm-hmm. She was packing her son off to Seattle.
That's right. And she leaned her head into Tiggs' shoulder.
Yeah.
And that was really a nice scene. But it was like, I looked at him like, oh, geez, you know, yeah. Tiggs is really going to get excited about this.
Well, but do you remember when he saw her? He's like, "Hey, baby," and you know, he's been a goner since the moment he saw her.
Oh yeah,
like they laid the groundwork for that. But the emotional connection is something that you know, you alluded to it, and then when they have the monologue, like both Tig and Venus are trying to play it cool, and everyone's like, "Why does Venus have Tig's phone number? And why is she calling him Alex? And why is he calling her baby? And all that?" And I'm like, "It." Really, this is a guy you know who once got arrested for having sex with a cow? Would it really surprise you?
Well, and who's also down with cold packing.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Oh, God, what a word.
Right.
But what I love is that I have a feeling that Venus is kind of Kurt Sutter's homage to Blanche DuBois. Because the fluttery, flowery, coquettish language. And then when he does this, "I am an angel that brings light into people who have despaired of the darkness." And part of me is rolling my eyes all, you know, dial it back, Goggins. And part of me is like, well, you know, this is a person who literally had to remake themselves from the ground up. And they're telling you what they choose to believe and what they choose to embrace. And Venus is one of the most positive things to ever come out of this show.
She really is.
And, yeah, she's amazing.
And
yeah.
As gross as normally I would conceive this, again, for some reason it plays with this huge open mouth kiss.
Yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, you know what? This is exactly what Tiggs needs. He needs that light.
He needs somebody who's going to say, "I can rebuild your." Of course, he may be dead of blood poisoning in the next episode because they no longer have Tara to do all their medical stuff for them.
We don't worry about that. We got rid of that in the script. Don't worry about that.
That's not they're gonna just hand wave that away. Oh, look, it's Tig, and he's managed not to get infected by this incredibly undertreated gut shot.
But again, this shorthand, then you throw Chibs in there, mm-hmm. and it's obvious that there's something going on, but there's nothing to indicate that.
Well, the stuff we're not seeing. I wonder how much of this is Chibs genuinely connecting and how much of this is him cynically making a play. Because we saw that the minute he had the conversation with Juice, like he goes running back to the club and says, "And then Juice says this, and then I said that, and so it's pretty obvious that he had once felt a very strong father-son connection with Juice, and like he's able to just put that aside for the good of the club. And so what I'm wondering is if he's like, well, this relationship with Althea will be good for the club, so let's just see where this goes. You know, she's an expensive first date, but she's worth it. I have a little bit of a gimlet eye toward it. What I do want to say is, and this circles back to episode 3, I'm a little heartbroken that Rad is hooking up with that sweet, crazy girl. Because that sort of torpedoes my whole, he's undercover as a police.
It does.
Unless he turns out he's undercover as a police and he's made some stupid errors. And
Nope. Yeah, he's Rat.
Yeah. I thought it was more interesting than that.
And some of his, the comedy between him and Tiggs now actually plays.
As a father-son thing.
Well, the whole thing, I bet you're getting hard over this.
Yeah, and he's all, "What did you say?" I said, "It's really hard to do this."
Right. I mean, some of these things are really starting to play well.
Yeah.
Again, we have now two people, Juice and Gemma, who mm-hmm. like to talk to themselves. Or
I think Gemma's going to kill Juice in the next episode, though, because you don't stick a gun with a silencer in your suitcase in at the end of the season's Act 1 if you're not going to have it go off in the middle of Act 2.
Well, and it's clearly both of them have a gun. It's the bomb under the table.
Yeah.
Something's got to give. And if it doesn't, that's a problem.
Yeah, I just don't have a good feeling. Because my theory was that Gemma was originally going to help Juice escape because she has this sense of, well, I owe you, and here we go, and you're off, and you can have a good life. And then Juice pulls the, "I can't be alone, and I'm gonna do everything I can to death by Chibs." And so I think what she's thinking now is, crap, he's just unhinged enough to really babble the truth. I need to keep this hidden. So she's going to lure him out of town on false pretenses and then find a way to kill him and then justify it to her birds / Tara as, well, this is just the next logical step. Don't you see it has to be this way because those boys and Jax need me. I can't go to jail.
I'm right there with you. The thing that really bothers me going into from here is... Mm-hmm. They've given no indication, at least to me, I haven't seen who the rat is that had pretty much spurred the Chinese to go completely AWOL and war zone.
Oh, I think Marx is smart enough to figure out what's going on, to be honest. And I think Marx has decided that he can take care of a one-niner slash grim bastards problem by letting them play pawns with jacks. And then after the shooting stops, he'll have his real estate deal. He'll have the streets cleaned of people who were pains in the neck to him anyway. And then knocking off Teller will be a piece of cake because jacks won't have a power base anymore.
But, you know, in storytelling, don't you have to at least show some of that? Like, it's the stuff that we're not seeing.
Do you remember the season 3 finale when they have the whole complicated plan that plays out with the double cross with the Russians and the ATF, where Jax is like, okay, here's the deal we'll make with the Russians for the gun and the money with the fake money that we have, and then we'll lead the ATF to the Irish, but secretly what we're doing is we're killing some Russians, we're taking the Russians off the table, and then the Irish are getting screwed over in a different capacity because we're killing off Jimmy O, and then we're also going to take care of...
the ATF girl.
Oh, yeah, whatever her name. I can't remember her name. It'll come to me in a moment. But remember, like, all of that was revealed later where... because. Up until that moment, we're like, oh, my God, Jax is working with Agent What's-Her-Name, and he's a rat, and he's going to go to jail. And then there's, like, this big twist reveal in, like, the last 5 minutes where it's like, I've been working with the club all along. I've never ran on one of my own. And on one level, it makes sense. And on another level, I'm like, dude, that's a Scooby-Doo ending.
And that no one – I remember that scene because they were all – in the paddy wagon together.
Yeah. And they start laughing once the, because they play it all the way through the arrest. They're rounded up in the van and, Allie Walker is gloating. And then the final third of their betrayal scheme drops and cause Unser's in on it too. And, oh gosh, who hits him? Is it Happy who hits? No, it's, Filthy Phil who hits him, I think.
I think it is.
No. It's Kozak who hits him. Sorry, it's Kozak. Anyway, you know, Unser gets knocked out and that there's a bus. And anyway, long story short, like at the very end, you see somebody riding a motorcycle past the van to indicate successfully that it's been that Jax's crackpot scheme has all worked out. You see the guys start to laugh and they're all friends again. And then Gemma is sitting on the bed holding the baby and there's Jax's, she's holding baby Abel. And then I think it is Rat or Filthy Phil who comes. It's Filthy Phil who comes in and says, "Oh, here's a letter that Jax wants me to give you." And then Jax narrates the letter, and you find out it was all a wild scheme, and I couldn't let you know. And I think what's going to happen is somewhere in the middle of Act Two, we're going to find out that Marx has actually been, you know, drawing a noose around Jax Teller because he's figured out correctly that Jax can't think his way out of a paper bag right now, and that's going to be what takes down the club. And Act Three will be, you know, Act Three will be. The truth about Tara's death dropping and then betrayal left, right, and center and however else it unwinds.
Well, and the other thing that we're left with when Pope is killed, you know, you think too much of me. I'm not that smart. But that has always, and I can't remember exactly when Marx talked about it, if it was this season or near the end of last. But they said they were still looking into Pope's death.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think he was doing that to keep Jax nervous, too. But it's been shown that Jax is not as bright as he likes to think he is.
Well, I think you're really on to something with the whole Hunman and the way he's playing this, because it's just hard to follow what his logic is. Mm-hmm. And his emotional state.
Well, I keep thinking he did such a great... Again, I think his characterization of Jax is fantastic. And if you go back and you look at the early stuff, early seasons compared to now, like, he plays Jax so differently in seasons 1 and 2. There's this lightheartedness to the character and this sort of life is a big joke. And you know, Abel is the catharsis for him beginning to question his place in the world and so on and so forth. But Jax generally has a pretty lively sense of humor and that starts to drain away around season 5. And we've seen it come back in flashes here and there, but he's playing a totally different character now. And I can't help but think that there's gotta be some big big emotional, put this on your Emmy reel, son, type thing coming up. Because, you know, like I said, his performance feels very opaque to me right now. And I find myself wondering, where are you going with this?
Well, and I'll even go back to episode three, where, or is it four? No, three. When Abel sees the whole beatdown between grandma and the father. When
Is daddy bad sometimes? That whole anvil-laden exchange, and Gemma's all, no, honey, he's wonderful. He never does anything bad. And you're all, no, no. The whole point here is the vicious circle continues.
Right. And then she even says it when she's having her little after Courtney Love talk to her, to Tara.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Abel's going to follow in your footsteps. Maybe Thomas will be, you know, a doctor.
She's like, Thomas will be a doctor, but oh, Abel, I can see it in his creepy little child actor eyes. He's going to be like his daddy. And, no, but
can I just say something? Courtney Love has to be the pastiest
human being
ever.
SPF 100 every day, all over, slathered top to bottom.
And her plastic surgery is like coming apart.
It's distracting.
Why put her in that role? Seriously.
Like I said, I think Kurt Sutter is trying to revive the Lollapalooza lineups he so enjoyed during the 90s. And really, we're just a couple episodes away from Kim Deal showing up as the music teacher.
Well, that would be fine with me. That would be the best music teacher ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Liz Phair starts working behind the counter at the candy store.
It could be great.
Oh my gosh, can you imagine the Red Hot Chili Peppers? They're like a scooter gang, not a bike gang, and they're like, wait, what? What is this?
Oh boy, here we go.
Oh, come on.
Well, we've already had Henry Rollins. He was part of Lollapalooza 1.
Chris Cornell as Wendy's new sobriety counselor.
It could work.
Actually, it could. No, Eddie Vedder shows up as the annoying holistic pot farmer.
He was the guy that always worked at Juice's Weed House.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He goes, oh, he's looking for Juice. He owes me money. And they're all, dude, I know who I look like.
Oh, I get that a lot.
Make it happen. They're still writing and record. They're still writing and filming episodes for November 1st. Please, you've got 4 weeks to make Eddie Vedder as Juice's pot employee happen.
That would be awesome. But Marilyn Manson actually did a pretty good job.
I miss my dogs.
I'm not saying it's Shakespeare here. I'm just saying.
So funny though, when he's like, well, why do we have to speak in code? I miss my dogs.
Yeah. I mean, it was just one of those, wait, what are you doing? Oh, I bought this room. I mean, there's a lot
I've
of really
enjoyed him whenever he's made a foray out of music into something else. Like he's a lot like Alice Cooper in his innate self-awareness.
I mean, you know, it just, he works. I don't see him as, I see him as that character, which is a great thing.
Yeah. So I also want to talk the things that made episode four was a lot funnier than episode three in so many ways. And if we can run down a list of the ways in which it was hilarious, that would be great. There was the whole, I miss my dogs thing. I loved the whole preschool scene because I loved, first of all, they managed to get the self-righteous tone of drop-off line completely right, because the ugliest culture battle we've had at my daughter's preschool has actually been over parking spaces.
Always.
Like, always, always. So they totally got that right. And I also really enjoyed, as Gemma is monologuing to Tara after drop-off, I enjoyed how she's monologuing, well, you know, I don't think you should drop off your kids to be raised by other people. And I'm like, says the woman who passes infants around a random crew of crow eaters every day of the week.
Right.
Like, what the what, Gemma? So the complete lack of self-awareness there was hilarious. At the 5-minute mark, when you see all the Diosa girls cleaning the place under the tutelage of Colette, I was like, you know, like a league of hookers cleaning a house, there's just something kind of funny about that, because they all looked really relieved to be doing that and not feigning interest in paunchy old Ben.
Well, all I know is when you're doing percents, does that mean math?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, God, that was such a great running gag. Let's see. When they mentioned, oh, good, leave Andre the Giant and Captain Psycho out of this month.
That was good.
I believe every word out of Borofsky's mouth qualifies as comedy gold.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And the exchange between Jax and Gemma, where she's razzing about Colette and your mommy fetish. He turns around and goes, first of all, if I had a mommy fetish, I'd be hooking up with a psycho dominatrix. Second of all, never, ever talk to me about a mommy fetish again. Like, I liked both the line and the fact that Jax and Gemma had a little bit of their teasing rapport.
Yes.
Because it's kind of a reminder of what they lost.
And it was one of those weird points. It was just like,
Well, then one of the exchanges at the end that cracked me up was when Bobby Elvis turns to Jax and goes, remember when our biggest problem was which Mayan to kill? And Jax goes, simpler times. And Bobby Elvis goes, simpler men. And that whips you right back around to season one when the Mayans were the big bad. Also, and this is something that only Bay Area viewers are going to find deeply hilarious, Lake Anza is actually in the middle of a park.
Uh-huh.
It's basically a reservoir in the middle of protected parkland. There are no houses on Lake Anza. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. And, you know, it cracks me up how nobody in the writer's room at Sons of Anarchy has a working knowledge of MapQuest or Google Maps or anything like that. They just pick this random thing out of thin air and go, oh, yeah, Lake Anza. I'm sure there's lake houses there. No, it's a park. No lake houses. The same way, like in season two, when they're like, oh, you know, this total racist kingpin had a cigar store in Alameda. And here's a pro tip. I live in Alameda, and trust me, the NIMBYs in this town go insane anytime a planned business wants to come to town. Like, we have, there's an In-N-Out that's coming in, and it took over a year for that sucker to get rammed through because you had people mobilizing, you know, oh, fast food outlets, bring in the wrong kind of people. And they like went digging into who was going to open it up and so on and so forth. Like, I guarantee you, if you had somebody who was going to open a cigar shop in Alameda, you'd have like a hundred Alamedans who go digging around, quickly find out what he's on to, and like begin picketing and going to City Hall and starting blogs about it. Trust me, I live here. This happens even with like organic grocery stores. This happens with children's pottery places. This happens with software companies. Like, there is no business in Alameda that does not undergo the scrutiny of 1,000 neighbors. So, like, between that and Lake Anza and their crazy impression that somehow you can get between Oakland and like Calaveras County in under 90 minutes with no rush hour traffic ever, like, it defies logic and reality and facts and everything that is known about California.
this is why for the rest of us we think California may break off and sink into the sea.
Yeah, well, because it's obviously folded like origami, since you can get from Stockton to Oakland in 20 minutes according to the logic of Sons of Anarchy.
Well, the wormholes, they have them on their bikes.
There have to be. Well, here's the thing: is there's this giant thing called the Altamont Pass between the Bay Area and the valley where Stockton is located, and the Altamont Pass is often shrouded in fog, and it is always choked with traffic. Like, you're at a standstill half the time on that thing. So with this whole, oh, we're going to zip to Oakland and back in a damn hole. Really, you think you're going to do that around rush hour? Good luck.
Well, it's a suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of, let's move on.
Oh, there was a really good scene for especially guys when Rat and Tiggs are, you know, doing their little graveside kibitz.
Yeah.
Just before the cut. And what would seem like Tiggs is wiping down the dead phone.
Yeah.
It really looks more like he's doing a little masturbation to the dead body action.
Yeah. It's like he can't help himself.
It really looks like that.
I wonder how much of that was I'm going to mess with this character. I'm going to mess with people too. Cause Tig was also really good about unnerving people deliberately. He used to do that with Opie too.
That's true.
But the whole grave thing was just out. Like, there's like a couple dainty coughs as they take care of this body. I'm like, no, you'd be coughing a lot more. But how relieved were you that they massacred all of the Diosa girls off screen?
How relieved?
Yeah, that's like something I didn't want to see at all. I mean, it's bad enough that they've had like a spray and pray every week with random gangsters being felled. But when the Lynn crew came in and I saw them take their positions, I thought, oh, God, this is just going to be horrible. And instead, what they did is they made a phone call, and then you come back and all you see are the bodies scattered everywhere.
Yeah, I was a little upset that Colette got killed. Because, you know, in the way she was presented in the episode, it look like, oh, look, I'm blonder and yeah. I look like I'm, you know, I've been getting fit. And
well, you also had the feeling that you had the sense that she's Jax's last chance at sanity because she's smart, she's grounded, she's compassionate, she's all of the things that Gemma is not, basically. And she's being, and you know, and Gemma was not off the mark with the mommy figure thing at all, frankly.
No.
And so there's the Colette Dodge. The thing that I wonder with about her death is we establish that Borofsky has a thing for her.
Oh boy.
And he is not going to be happy about how his friend slash crush object was gunned down for entirely specious reasons. I think Borofsky has, like, before it was evident he's a dirty cop and he's just kind of playing it the most profitable way it lays. But I think now he's got to have a grudge against Handsome Jack, and he's going to jump at an opportunity to enact that for Colette.
Well, boy, that's interesting to think about. All of the allies, he was setting things up so everybody would kill each other, and now it seems to be redirecting where these little things, these side plays, are going to come right back at the club. But yeah. Borofsky, that's going to be a big one.
Yeah. Because, he loved Colette. It was pretty, and it was evident that some of the animus he had towards Jax last season was the fact that Colette had eyes for Jax, and he's always had a thing for Colette. So
that's right. Well, the first time he sees Colette, or wasn't it? It was. They were.
Jax walks in. Jax walks in on Colette doing the business with Borofsky, and that's when he realizes this is why Borofsky's been so to him.
That's right.
Yeah. And this also gives us the stakes, which explain a lot of the antagonism too. But anyway, I'm curious to see where this preschool plotline goes, because it could be very amusing in a fish out of water kind of way. Like, it looks like they're at a Montessori type preschool, and the people who, and it's one of those things where, we're progressive and we're open-minded, and then you run smack up against somebody who doesn't fit the monoculture, and we'll see how progressive and open-minded you are.
Well, and the thing is, they didn't.
I'm intrigued to see where it goes.
Yeah, and Courtney Love doesn't really look like, she's definitely looks homely, but she doesn't look like homely teacher, which makes me believe, okay, there's going to be a side story with this one.
Mm-hmm.
Like ex-crow eater. Even though it doesn't seem like she's.
They did that. They did that with Margaret, the hospital administrator, and I was so disappointed when they did that. I used to be a drug mule, and then I overdosed, and I keep this tattoo as a reminder. And that was just such BS. Like maybe there are actually people who didn't spend their 20s committing assorted felonies and still have to deal with you folk. How about that, huh?
Was that season 2?
Margaret was the Margaret revelation was season 3, because that's when there's the kidnapping.
Right.
They kidnap Tara when she's on her way to go get an abortion, and bizarrely, this leads her to change her mind. And I can't even, that whole thing was just, no, what Tara needed were a few good girlfriends, because then season 3 would have ended with like her girlfriends giving her an intervention, driving her to Planned Parenthood, and then her like going off to Chicago all later.
One thing I do want to ask you, who is Juice talking to? If Gemma's talking to
Tara,
what who's Juice talking to? Because it seemed like he was talking almost to Jax.
Yeah. Chibs would be my guess.
I could see that.
That's his father figure.
Mm-hmm.
He's sure shit not talking to Roosevelt.
Yeah. Well, what? Mm-hmm. Oh, two guns going to Oregon. It's not going to be either one of them that dies. It's going to end up being Unser or Wendy.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be Wendy. I think Wendy's now played out.
You think so?
It wouldn't surprise me, but it would surprise me, if that makes sense. Like, I don't. Yeah.
Like, you'd be like, oh my God, they pulled the trigger on that. I didn't think they would.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The reason I hope she stays alive is because I kind of hope that it's a nice bit of karmic revenge that the woman Gemma tried so hard to kill in the season premiere is the woman who ends up raising all of Jax's kids in the season finale.
That's what I think it's going to end out to be.
Yeah, I really hope that's the case. That said, I also really hope that she doesn't get back together with Jax. I liked her scene with the child whose name I'm forgetting when the girl's like, but I love Rhett. And she's like, eh, you know what? You can love him, but that doesn't mean you should be with him.
Oh, Brooke.
And Brooke. And Brooke's like, don't you love Jax? And she's like, I love him, but I can't be with him. And she makes that important distinction. So I'm hopeful that that distinction stays maintained. I think we can agree that Unser is a goner, mostly because Unser has finally realized exactly what he's helped everybody get away with.
Well, and it seems like his purpose is starting to dry up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he really...
He's also got stage 4 cancer. At some point, shouldn't it be killing him?
You would think. But the marijuana helps.
Yeah. I mean, pot helps with the pain, but it's not going to stop cancer cells from dividing. What the heck?
Yeah, I'm a little mystified about that myself. I mean, really, yeah. He should be barely moving.
Mm-hmm.
And in some serious, I'm in bed pain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had a girlfriend who went through chemo. I've had two girlfriends who have gone through chemo for assorted stage 3 and stage 3B cancers. And like that shiz incapacitates you. Like you're literally doing nothing else for 6 months. And yet Unser is blithely moving bodies or helping people cover things up or baby stink the last minute to high energy small children. It just makes no sense.
Yeah. And the thing is he's given,
it's like TV cancer is like TV children where like the children are always quiet or this is always my favorite. You have a 3-year-old who's sitting there doing puzzles and scribbling quietly instead of, you know, demanding to see someone's phone or running rings around them.
Correct.
The babies never cry or the babies are always asleep. And I'm all, I hate TV children. I hate TV children so much. I think you can write around them. I don't think you need to see them. And TV cancer is as bad as TV children because TV cancer is, oh, he's a little clammy in the scene. Oh, we need an excuse to write this actor off. But like, you never really see them, you know, grappling with the awful reality of chemotherapy or radiation or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you got the chemo, you're not doing much.
No. No, it saps your energy and you're tired and you're sick and your appetite's gone because your body is being poisoned and there's all sorts of stuff going on. So.
But what else does he have to contribute? I mean, he's already given the sheriff about all the lay of the land and said, finally, you know, this place is messed up.
I think the only thing he can honestly do at this point is be Gemma's last ditch conscience and we'll watch her kill him or help him get killed. And we'll be like, okay, this is it. She has no humanity left. Cause again, she's a hugely tragic figure. And one of the big tragedies is every time she has the chance for healthy love with somebody, she sabotages it through her own fear and anger. And Unser and Nero are both people who love her in a very pure and unconditional way. She uses that and she's going to be the death of both of them. Like she's so consumed with self-loathing for herself that she can't comprehend why good people would love her. And so she needs to drag them down to her level and kill them.
Speaking of Nero.
He's a dead man walking.
He used the word diplomat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if this is ringing true, he's going to find himself. Yeah. I think he is on a very short rope.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's dead by the end of the series because he can't walk away from Gemma.
Ugh.
Yeah, this is the thing, and this is something I noticed, and we got to wrap this up, we're at 50 minutes, God.
Uh-oh.
The thing that I've noticed, or rather, I think the thing that Sutter was trying to underscore in episode 3, when Gemma comes in with the cake, like there's that whole creepy exchange where she's got the cake in the carrier, and Jax is like, thanks, Mom, and she's like, any excuse to bake, and then she goes and she pulls the femme fatale business with Hooker dad, just so she can, you know, ease the way for her son to go in and beat the crap out of the guy. Like, I thought, wow, this is just another example of how Gemma has to drag everyone down to her level, how she positions it as she loves them and she's giving and she's doing a favor. And what it really is there's something poisonous in the very nature of this person that she cannot do anything productive. It's everything she does is fruit from the poison tree. And I believe my notes actually drop an F-bomb because I was just that creeped out by it.
I can see that.
Yeah. The other heartbreaking thing that Gemma did in these last two episodes, episode 3 at the 6-minute mark, when Nero was planning to move to Dior Sonorte, and he and Jem are negotiating a Rahul visit where, and she's like, maybe you can move in with me. And he's like, oh, everybody else. And she's like, oh, everyone's under my roof right now. And she's carping, but you can tell she's kind of happy. And he goes, oh, you like a full house, Grandma. And Gemma goes, I do. And like, you can tell that she's really happy about it for a minute. And then she remembers what she had to do to get it.
Yeah.
And like, there is nothing in Gemma's life that's 100% joyful or sincere. And it's eating her up inside. The only question is whether she goes down still lying and fighting and trying to take people down with her, or whether she finally gives in to the worst demons of her nature. And she's like, please kill me because I just can't live with this anymore.
I can see maybe that.
Yeah.
I would be more satisfied if she were to come clean and then release herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause, it's obvious Sutter loves the character, and it's obvious that Katie Sagal puts a lot of thought into her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's wrap this up.
Do it.
Question for you.
Yes.
We've, again, 6.25 years of watching this whole thing. I honestly think that some of my favorite moments are the tiny ones that are not real, that the actors just do because they're good at what they do. Like when Bobby Elvis is walking among the dead hookers and you see him stroking the hair of one very gently while he examines her body. Who do you think are the actors who have given their characters the richest inner lives and deepest backstories?
Ooh. Oh boy. Let's think about that. Of the side players,
any of them.
I think I'm gonna have to go with Tiggs.
Yeah.
I want to say Chibs, but mm-hmm. you know, with the Irish stuff, it's like, It's hard for me to, he's still got a wife and kid, and that seems to be kind of forgotten about.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. And so it's not indicative of his character as I have seen it for 6.2.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a hard time with that. And as we've talked about it, I'm starting to see a bigger arc with Tiggs than with anybody. He was Clay's right hand man.
Yeah.
He was sunk to the bottom, basically a servant of Jack's, mm-hmm. then was re-entrusted, lost his family.
Yeah.
And then now has found love. I mean, look, he's the only character that maybe has a continuous thread of something going on with him.
He's got a redemption arc, because remember at one point Jax was going to hand him over to Poe.
Like,
was
right.
Dead set on doing it, and then was like, no, I'll come through for you, brother.
And in fact, he was given up to Pope. He was mm-hmm. given up to Marx, and that was a test. So really, Tiggs is reborn.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way of looking. I had not looked at it that way, and that's perfect. That's a perfect metaphor for it.
I think we see at the end of this thing some sort of Ozzy and Harriet moment with mm-hmm. Alexander and Venus.
Yeah. Like, you're never going to see him marching in a pride parade with, bikers, like, with bikers for transgender. You're never going to see him organize that float. And you're never going to see him at San Francisco's Gay Pride. But he's going to be the guy who totally squires Venus around town and feels like it's a pleasure and a privilege to do it.
See, and for whatever reason, it doesn't feel gay to me. And
it's not, because Venus is a woman.
That must be it.
Yeah, Venus is a woman, 100%. I mean, that's the thing is I think I keep trying to sell this piece, and no publication has picked it up yet, but I keep trying to sell this piece that Sons of Anarchy is actually one of the most feminist shows on television. And everybody is like, oh yeah, there's guns and violence and motorcycles and it's macho. But like, this is the same show that has basically advanced the idea that you're whatever gender you're going to be. And there's nothing wrong with that. And you are who you are, you know, as long as you're authentic. And that's, you know, that's a message that a lot of people are still having a hard time wrapping their head around. Like, Venus has been fantastic.
Really and truly.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
It's got to be Tiggs. Maybe this is just mm-hmm. Tiggs' story.
I hope. I love that character so much.
Dreamy.
Well, not so much. No, I've never had a crush on him, if that makes sense. I've always loved watching him, though, just because, like I said, I think Kim Coates is just such a thoughtful actor.
Well,
and like when such he was a consummate
in,
pro.
Yeah, mm-hmm. When he was in, the first time I really recognized him was The Last Boy Scout.
I've never seen that.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to have to see it, aren't I?
Well, yeah, you are.
Okay.
It's fantastic is what it is. I've watched mm-hmm. it at least 30 times.
Okay. All right. I'm going to have to watch it and like text my reaction. What? But what's funny is now that I know who he is, when he pops up in the background in the movie, it's one of those, hey, it's that guy moments. I'm like, oh, it's my little actor friend. You know, it's the weird one-way relationship you have with certain actors where you're happy to see them because you know you're going to get a good role out of them. But yeah, I was thinking Bobby Elvis is another one who doesn't get enough credit for, like, there's a running joke on Previously TV, which I love, by the way, where they're like, sad Bobby is sad. But what I love about this character is how they started off with, oh, he's a biker who was also an Elvis impersonator. But then you find out, like, he's actually really good at making chocolate chip cookies. He's kind of tired of screaming hookers, but, you know, it's kind of hard to meet other women in his line of work. You know, he's got kids. You get the sense that he reads. He's kind of, he's there's a lot going on. And, like, I'm never surprised by what they choose to reveal about the character, because the way that he's played is again, somebody who clearly has spent a lot of time trying to live inside Bobby's head and figure out what's going on in there. And it just flows naturally.
He definitely is probably the quintessential member of mm-hmm. a club who yeah. just loves the club and will do anything for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes means I'm going to go and recruit and not tell mm-hmm. you. And yeah. I believe in people.
Mm-hmm.
And in yeah. fact,
I mean, he's still kind of a dirtbag because he's the one that basically had blackmail sex with Luann all through season two. Let's not put this guy on a pedestal, but
no, we're not going to put him on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But he was seduced.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually he made the, I can't remember who made the offer, but basically came down to, let us have sex and you won't say anything to the club about me doing double books. And they were both fine with that deal. So there was a certain amount of complicity there.
Well, then there was the whole prison clause.
Yeah. Well, there was, but you know, well, what's his nut?
Otto.
Big Otto didn't take to it too well.
No. Oh. What's he going to
do? I'm not a fan of Sutter as an actor, but I really do love that they made Big Otto kind of unreasonably insane on only two subjects in the world, and those two subjects were Luann and the club.
Yeah. And if you want to see Sutter acting in a way that just doesn't make sense, yeah. I highly recommend watching The Shield.
Oh, God. I had to stop after like three seasons because it was just getting me down. I'm going to have to go back to it, I think.
Well,
but
I don't know.
Yeah. But no, I thought that, I'm blanking on who plays Bobby Elvis. This is terrible.
I can't think of it either
Mark Boone.
There we go.
Mark Boone and Kim Coates are both extraordinarily thoughtful actors. I thought Maggie Stiff was fantastic when she was doing Tara, just because, and it was a challenge because Tara's character was so self-contained. And so, you know, trying to play somebody like that, where this is somebody who by nature keeps their cards close to the vest, and to still manage to portray all these different layers, like that's just such brainy work. I loved it.
I couldn't buy into her.
Oh yeah?
I don't know what it was.
She's your Opie. Oh my gosh.
She might be.
Yeah. Cause the only I've liked Opie for, well, actually, that's not true. I thought he had some great line deliveries, and I think Ryan Hurst did a good job. I just didn't ever warm to the character. But
I liked him as Jax's second. Like it just mm-hmm. If I could have looked into the future, like from season three,
yeah.
and saw those two as Prez and Vice Prez, mm-hmm. I could have been, that would have been a very, very happy time. It wouldn't have been a very interesting story.
No, because it would have been a functional club.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's why Tiggs wins.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've loved his character.
I hated him in the beginning, now I love him. I hated him because he was Clay's second. I hated him for that.
Because you're like, what do you do other than carry out the orders of this clearly despicable person? And then you find out that no, he cried like a baby, and when he killed Donna, and he's been living with the guilt. I really have to point out that the fact that I can still find Gemma so intriguing and heartbreaking is just a tremendous testimony to the work that Katie Sagal does with the character.
That's true. I mean,
there's a lot of, I feel like because Gemma is such a monster that it's really easy to overlook how hard you have to work to play a character who is capable of doing horrible things and still play them as a relatable human being.
Yeah.
And Katie Sagal's just phenomenal.
She shines every episode. Every episode.
I mean, I'm not a fan of when they have her sing on the montages. Like, yeah. I could absolutely do without that, but.
I fully understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And, also, and this is so silly, like, she's the only one who can actually work with those kid actors and make it look convincing.
I will buy that in a heartbeat. Yeah. Except Abel has a face like the face from Halloween.
It's unsettling. There's that movie that's coming out, Annabelle, with the doll.
Yes.
And like, take away the braids and it's Abel. Oh,
yes.
So creepy. So on that child bashing note, shall we end for this time?
That sounds perfect to me.
Yeah. And now we're all super excited about where this is going. I have the feeling we just ended act one. So let's see what the second act of Mayhem and Destruction does. Let's see if it inspires us to keep coming back week after week, or if Philip and I are going to go rogue a few more times.
That's right. No, we won't. We'll go into we're going into third gear.
All right. Third gear. Fourth.
It's power gear.
All right. Thanks for sticking with us with this hour-long flashcast for TV. I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And I'm Phil Mosalak.
All right. See you next time.
Bye-bye.